Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Angus Riley, Assistant Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. America heads to the polls for an election marked by presidential withdrawals, political violence, and a profound contest over the future and identity of the United States. No previous election, however, has likely been invoked as many times as the 1968 race, won by Richard Nixon. Joining me to discuss that race and its enduring relevance is Luke Nichter, Professor of History at Chapman University and author of the book The Year That Broke Politics, about the election of that year. Luke, why do we continue to be fixated on election 56 years ago? Why do we fear it and revere it?
Well, first, it's a pleasure to be with you, especially in another divisive election season. You know, I think anytime you see what the media tells us each time we approach another election, and it's often the same kind of message. You know, the country is more divided than ever before, perhaps. Are there parallels in U.S. history? How did we get to this point? You know, we frequently know the right questions to ask, but we are not knowledgeable enough about history to utilize it in a way that helps to illuminate the present. So I think 68 is one of these elections that's invoked so often because it becomes the kind of political perfect storm. You know, as you said in the introduction, I mean, consider the relevance. You know, I don't think history repeats itself exactly, or does it rhyme, as some people say. But you consider a surprise late presidential withdrawal. You consider a vice presidential succession, not because that candidate is considered to be the strongest by that party, but because that candidate is the least disruptive to be inserted in the remaining infrastructure of the president who is withdrawn. Stronger than usual third-party challenges, including one named Robert Kennedy, a Republican desperate to find his way to the White House after a previous defeat. I would say a lack of trust. This is a big one, too. I think a critical lack of trust among Americans in national institutions, whether it be the national media, all levels of government, political parties, civic organizations, organized religious figures. I think that the bottom line for me is we've reached a point when it seems to be leaders of institutions in the country, rather than protecting Americans, Americans wonder whether they've been harming them in recent years. And the people in these positions and the political establishment itself seem to be shaken by this chaos and this turbulence and don't seem to have the answers.
But what do you think we get out of making this comparison?
Well, as I say, history doesn't repeat itself. But in this case, I think 68 has consistently been a good guide to such an extent that it even gives you things to look for. So in July, when President Biden was forced to step aside, you know, we could look at records in 1968 when Johnson was stepped aside, or even earlier in 52 when Harry Truman stepped aside. In 68, Johnson's decision to withdraw late in the race after the primaries began is useful because now that his archival records have started to come out, his more personal papers in recent years, it allowed you in 2024 to ask certain questions or to have things to look for. For example, after Johnson withdrew, gradually his top staff defected, and many of them were working for another candidate or at least after hours while maintaining their White House position. For example, when Harris became the nominee in Chicago, again, like another wild convention in Chicago, another parallel with 68, you know, I was doing some writing and speaking and saying something like, the lesson of 68 is that the difficulty that Harris has with history is that everything she says as a candidate is going to be measured against everything she said in the past for any perceived difference as vice president. And in particular, the media will be comparing anything she says as a candidate to anything Biden says. The media, when they do their job, those will be the hooks for new stories in the fall campaign. And so I think when you study this, I think the 68 pattern, first of all, 68 is the last time we had a president withdrawal, or sort of forced out late in a campaign. I think what history allows you to do, it doesn't repeat, it doesn't rhyme, but it informs you in a way that you know what to look for. It doesn't predict the future either. It helps you to filter your newsfeed in a way that's different with that knowledge of history, but also gives you things to look for as we move ahead in the campaign.
So let's set the scene for January 1968. What is the domestic and international position of the United States at this point?
Well, in late 67 or in early 68, Lyndon Johnson was preparing to run for re-election with his running mate, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey. They, of course, had won in 1964 in one of the four great landslides of the 20th century, so they appeared to be in a strong position. A difference, however, is that Vietnam had gone from being a strength, an asset for Johnson, and it truly was an asset because it rallied Americans around the flag in 64 and 65 and even parts of 66. But after the 66 midterms, when the Democrats, they held on to their power, not of course in the White House, but also in the House and the Senate, but by narrower margins. I think after that point, Vietnam really goes from being an asset to becoming a liability. So at the outset of 68, you look at the events of the year 1968, not just the campaign, and almost every month of that year contains some explosive revelation, some event that could never have been anticipated just a month before. And so the year begins with the Tet Offensive, this sort of simultaneous coordinated surprise attack on American and allied forces in South Vietnam, the North Korean seizure of the USS Pueblo. And that's just in the first month of the year. And every month thereafter, in 1968, there's another event. And I think the pace of that year is such that we never had time to digest each month's events. It's really taken the passage of decades and historians to look at it, perhaps with a more dispassionate lens, especially a generation of writers who weren't there, who weren't in Vietnam, who weren't on college campuses, who weren't caught up in unrest in that moment. This book came out 55 years after the 68 campaign, and me written after, this is ancient history for me that I grew up learning, just like every other younger person. I think it's taken a certain passage of time for us to finally be able to look back and make sense of it all.
So in March 1968, Johnson does take the extraordinary step of withdrawing from the race. Why does he do so?
I think our understanding of this is still evolving, even to this day. And, you know, and there are some parts of this book that I feel like I had a lot new to add, and there are other parts I didn't. And I just try to be transparent about that, you know, with the reader. There are people who really blaze trails on certain subjects like the anti-war movement that I didn't have as much to add. But on this one, I think we do have a fresh understanding of Johnson's withdrawal. And I think what I explain is we have some new source material. And as a writer, it's difficult writing about someone, Lyndon Johnson, who, as far as we know, was not a writer himself. So he doesn't write extensive memos. He doesn't keep a diary, a personal writings, at least not so far. That there are lots more Johnson records that are still being opened at his library in Austin, Texas. But at least among these releases, there hasn't been a lot of personal materials. But Lady Bird's diary has come out, and that's been extremely instructive because she was ahead of her time in many ways. I think she's much more than just a first lady, and really at times serving more in a role of a chief strategist for LBJ. And frequently her diary entries, which she is writing almost every day, she's dictating them, and then they're being typed up later by assistants. Frequently, they not only capture Johnson's views, but he'll interrupt her while she's dictating, and you can hear him interrupt her, kind of come into the room where she's doing this work. Or she'll say things like, you know, today on the Hill, this really bothered us, you know, Senator Fulbright. You know, I mean, it'll be some commentary that clearly is something that she's picked up from him, or at least she knows his thinking well enough. And what her diary and other news sources tell us, as we know now, is Johnson was considering withdrawing much earlier. This was not a snap decision in response to the Tet Offensive, as much of the first draft of history said about Johnson's withdrawal. Her diary even suggests that he had decided as early as 64 that he would run and presumably win, but not run again. And so I don't think Johnson's thinking was static at any moment. I think it evolved based on, I think his health was a much bigger factor. His health records have largely not been opened yet. I think that the daughters especially don't want to open that just yet. I've begun to see some of that, but I think his health was a much bigger factor. His own father died when he was 60 as a result of a health issue, a complication from a stroke. And in 1968, it's hard to believe by the standards of contemporary American politics, Johnson looked very old and was considered old at age 60. Yeah. And so I think he wanted to have some kind of a retirement on the ranch. He wanted to spend time with his family. He'd been in Washington since the 1930s and had really never left. And he wanted to see his grandkids and see them grow up. And so Johnson had a very short post-presidency, only about 4 years. But I think he wanted to have at least that much time following the White House.
Did Biden's withdrawal reshape your or adjust your perspective on Johnson's withdrawal. Obviously, you can sort of present it as the parallels between them extending from Johnson, but looking backwards, did it change your opinion at all?
It's a good question, and I don't know if we're supposed to do history that way. I mean, we're also not supposed to look at the past and look for things that haven't happened yet. So I don't know if that's the right way of doing history, but I suppose as a human being, you can't help but allow, you know, my understanding of Truman in 52 to affect Johnson in 68 and Biden, and also looking backwards, as you say. I think that will be fascinating for future historians, because if it took 50 years for the 68 records to be opened up, you know, it might take that long for Biden records to be opened up. Yeah. And is Joe Biden keeping a diary, you know, the way that Lady Bird did? It would be fascinating. Yeah. Is Biden a writer or more of a writer than LBJ was? You know, it'd be fascinating to consider one day. So I don't know if it affects the way I look at Biden. I tell you one thing I take away from Truman and Johnson, it gives me a great deal of empathy and even sympathy in a way for Biden. And the questions I would ask about Biden in particular, based on history, is I'm guessing, like Truman and Johnson, Biden's decision was under consideration for a much longer period of time. Yeah. I would guess that people around him did know his thinking very well because, you know, Truman withdrew on March 29th of 52. Mm. Johnson was March 31st. Well, Biden waited until July.
Yes.
So from a historical standpoint, March was really the month to watch because it was considered late for Truman and Johnson after the New Hampshire primary, but still early enough that there could be sort of a primary and Democrats could work out what they wanted to do. I guess going forward, it's a sample size of three. And if Truman's not documented terribly well, but I think future historians, by looking at the past, I think will already be forearmed with the right questions and the right things to look at when those Biden records become available.
So the three main competitors for the Democratic nomination after this point are Vice President Hubert Humphrey, Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy, and New York Senator Robert Kennedy. Tell us about those candidates and what their approach to the election was.
I mean, this is a difficult book to write in the sense that it's a well-known story. That part wasn't the hard part. The hard part is how do you structure it? So you have those candidates on the Democratic side, and you have a host of other brand names on the Republican side, you know, which we'll get to in a little bit. But, you know, which ones do you treat effectively? You know, it's like a screenplay. Which ones are sort of your major actors or actresses, and which ones are your lesser or minor actors or actresses, and which ones just make brief cameos? So I decided to focus the book on the three that were on the ballot, of course. So yeah. Humphrey, Nixon. And initially, I wasn't even planning to focus on Wallace much, or maybe much lesser, sort of in proportion to the 10 million votes and only the 45 electoral college votes he got. But it was really what I learned from doing interviews was critical in terms of the structure of the book, not the argument, but the structure. And it was the LBJ people that I talked to who said, you have to treat Wallace as a full equal with Humphrey and Nixon. I said, well, why? He wasn't. He's a third party. Who knows anything about the American Independent Party? And the Johnson people said to me something like, because LBJ considered Wallace to be a major candidate. He gave him the same national security briefings. He was on the same conference calls with Humphrey and Nixon. And that changed my perspective, you know, as a historian. And so I decided, well, I'm going to focus on those three. And the other different thing about my book is it really treats Johnson as a major actor throughout. And most books, after Johnson withdraws on March 31st, treat him as a non-entity. He's a lame duck. All the excitement shifts to the challengers. Johnson's obviously on his way out. He's not interesting anymore. So I focus on the three that were on the ballot and Johnson. And those are sort of my four major characters, you know, who at least get sort of entire chapters on their own. And then on the Democratic side, you know, it's crude and, you know, to say the also-rans, because Eugene McCarthy was more than an also-ran, and certainly Robert Kennedy was more than an also-ran. But they were fascinating each in their own way, that Johnson had not one, and Humphrey, not one challenger, but two. And if you count Wallace challenging from the right, because Wallace considered himself to be a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, then, you know, he had not only strong third party challenges, and not like in 2024, where you have, you know, an anonymous member of the House, you know, that no one's heard of, and Biden really had no opposition. But these are two brand name senators. You know, Eugene McCarthy, I think, the first to challenge him from Minnesota. I mean, the courage you can imagine within the president's own party to sort of declare your independence and to challenge him, I think that takes real political courage, whether you're for the policies or not. And then for Kennedy to join him in the challenge after the New Hampshire primary, I think would have made that very difficult for Johnson.
But with Kennedy in particular, after his assassination in June 1968, there was a lot of mythologizing about his character, his positions, him as a liberal icon, but also I think his capacity to win. So Humphrey wins without entering primaries. It is the last sort of backroom primary election, really. And so how much do you think we just do mythologize the insurgent candidates against the Democratic establishment?
Yeah, I felt like I wrestled with that. And I guess my approach to telling this part of the story was just different in the sense that since I'm focusing on what Lyndon Johnson's thinking, I tell the story differently. So I make the argument in the book that a withdrawal from the ballot, as Johnson does on March 31st, is not a withdrawal from politics. That if anything, Johnson was even more active and worked even harder after March 31st. Well, then what was he working on? He was working on his legacy. He was trying to influence the choice of his successor. But I think Johnson understood that in presidential politics, your successor can do an awful lot to help or to harm your own legacy and history. And I think Johnson initially wanted Nelson Rockefeller, thought he was most ideologically compatible and on policy issues. I think Johnson didn't think Johnson was not close to McCarthy, and he certainly didn't want to be sandwiched between Kennedy presidencies. But then, of course, McCarthy's campaign doesn't really go anywhere, and then Kennedy is killed, tragically, after the California primary. And in the midst of that, Nelson Rockefeller, thanks to a young staffer, speechwriter, Harvard professor Henry Kissinger, by about May is making very critical statements about Vietnam and Johnson's management of it. And so Rockefeller and Johnson, Rockefeller doesn't appear to be the successor the way that Johnson had hoped, even though Johnson made, I think, at least two or three attempts to get Rockefeller to run. And so you can see Johnson's not static throughout this year. He's maneuvering. So I think first he sort of leans toward Nelson Rockefeller. Well, then Humphrey has the nomination by default after the, sort of all the other candidates don't materialize and Kennedy is killed. And I think at that point, Johnson even considers coming back in the race, thinking that maybe it wasn't a final withdrawal on March 31st. And we don't know how serious that is, but I think he certainly toyed with that idea. And then the story that I tell, the most controversial argument, is that Johnson actually came to prefer Nixon ultimately for his own legacy.
Okay, so how does Nixon come back in 1968? He had lost to Kennedy in 1960. He had famously withdrawn from politics after losing the California governor race in 1962. He seemed like a spent man, but then suddenly he is the Republican nominee again.
I admit that I'm a cynic when it comes to politics. You know, I assume that no politician gives up political power until they absolutely have to. Well, Nixon's a case where he was rejected by the political establishment. I mean, he lost narrowly in 60. He lost more decisively and really in humiliating fashion in 1962. And I think at that point, thought his political career was over. I mean, it's easy to look back and now say, oh, no, he was just going to strategize and he was going to come back in 68. I don't think so. I mean, he really pulled up those tent stakes in California. He moved cross-country to practice law in New York City. You know, Manhattan is not the typical place, if you're a Republican, to recuperate a political career. I mean, I suppose unless you're Donald Trump, I guess, which is a whole other subject. But I think Nixon really did give up on politics and thought it was over. And he wrote at one point, I'm finally making a good living. He's living off of Park Avenue by Central Park. He's traveling the world. He's recruiting clients for a major white shoe Wall Street law firm. His family is prospering. Pat Nixon is happy, probably for the first time in her life. The daughters are doing well. They're becoming adults and enjoying New York life. And I think Nixon thought, I'm going to be dead in 5 years. I think it was intellectually draining. He desired to get back in the arena, you know, as he called it. And I think that he gave a lot of thought to it, I think. But in the closing months of 1967 is when he finally made his decision. I don't think it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to run again, and certainly not that he would win. His mother, Hannah, died in late 67, and Billy Graham officiated. The Reverend Billy Graham, the evangelical minister, officiated at Hannah Nixon's funeral. And on her deathbed, Hannah Nixon said, "Dick, don't give up. You'll get another chance." And we forget that even after 8 years as Eisenhower's vice president, which is not a bad way to be trained in politics, Nixon was only something like 48 years old. I mean, pretty young, certainly by standards of today and even by standards of then. And so if he waited for the right political timing, he might have another chance. And so I think it was Hannah Nixon's encouragement and also Billy Graham's. I think the family was very much divided. I think we don't know exactly. I think Pat Nixon didn't want to go through with it again. I think the two losses were devastating, emotionally, financially to the family. I think the daughters were still young and naive and thought it was exciting. And they were sort of in their late teens, 20 years old, you know, so it wouldn't be cool if Dad was president. And I think they were more for it. And so Pat went along with it. But I think it was an arduous process for Nixon to make that decision.
So both Humphrey and Nixon, well, they have very different conventions, and there's a real contrast between them. And to be honest with you, like, the Chicago Convention is probably one of the defining themes, defining images of the 1968 election. What are the stories of those conventions, and how much do they matter in this grander picture?
I think people remember the chaos of Chicago, and millions of Americans were in their sitting rooms watching on television the anti-war protests, the counterculture leaders in Chicago. And Chicago is America's greatest convention city. It's hosted more than any other. But from a security standpoint, it's almost impossible. These large public parks like Grant Park, you have Lake Michigan. It's very difficult to secure in terms of a convention site. And in politics and in recent decades, security is so critically important. And so people remember the chaos and the violence in which Mayor Richard Daley's police took part and in some cases incited or encouraged the violence. But I think the other fundamental issue of Chicago was how much the political winds were beginning to shift in the United States. And I think that first draft of history written by eyewitness observers, by those who'd worked on one campaign or covered a campaign as a journalist, missed those broader shifts that were taking place as millions of Southern Democrats were leaving the party and becoming Republicans. Lyndon Johnson was the last Democratic president to win the blue-collar voters as a bloc in 1964. So I think major political shifts were happening that were all part of what was going into Chicago. So the Chicago convention outside was chaotic, but inside, there was really no question that Hubert Humphrey had the nomination. You know, people, going back to your earlier comment, people wonder, well, if Kennedy had lived, you know, could he have gotten the nomination? I mean, this is all what-if history. You know, historians are not supposed to engage in these kinds of speculation, although we love it. It's fascinating. But there's no doubt that Kennedy was killed right at the moment that he was beginning to peak and really rally young people who were a little disappointed, I think, in McCarthy's campaign. But still, you referred to it at 68 as being sort of the last backroom deal, the last time that Democrats used a backroom process to nominate someone. Today, we call them superdelegates. In 68, superdelegates controlled large blocks of votes. The process had not been liberalized by what became known as the McGovern Commission, ultimately nominating McGovern in 72. In 68, almost every state and county chairman owed loyalty to Lyndon Johnson. So therefore, most of them transferred their loyalty to Hubert Humphrey. So it was really no question that he probably was going to get the nomination. However, if Kennedy had lived, it would have been awfully interesting in Chicago. I still think it would have been difficult for Kennedy to overcome that resistance because Kennedy was running as an insurgent in a year that was really designed to coronate Lyndon Johnson for another term of office. And Humphrey inherited all that political strength. So you have the chaos of Chicago, including the actual day in Chicago designed to nominate the presidential candidate was Lyndon Johnson's 60th birthday, August 27th. And he'd been nominated 4 years before in Atlantic City on his birthday, his 56th birthday. The convention was set late. It was all according to Lyndon Johnson's timing in 1968. He was going to be the candidate. The convention was set late because he didn't want a candidate campaign, have a long campaign in the fall. And so everything about the convention was wrong if Humphrey was the candidate. And Johnson was unwilling to make the change.
Johnson wasn't there.
He wasn't the, exactly. Yeah. Humphrey wanted to switch to Miami Beach, where the Republicans were, which is much easier from a security standpoint, because Miami Beach, which is separate from Miami, if you know South Florida, Miami Beach can be secured by raising a couple of bridges and causeways. And so from a security standpoint, it's much easier. And Nixon started off with, you know, a number of sort of household name challengers. We mentioned Nelson Rockefeller, California Governor Ronald Reagan, Michigan Governor George Romney, Mitt Romney's father. I mean, serious challengers, none of whom really materialized. And Nixon ended up being the only candidate of either party to run a complete campaign from New Hampshire all the way to Election Day in November. And so he had the most experience. Of course, he'd done it before in 60, and he knew campaigning. He'd been on the national ballot every year from 1952 to 1972, except 64, and he almost wasn't 64. So Nixon had a lot of experience. He knew what it took to run a campaign and go the distance. And so Nixon's convention, by contrast with the Democrats in Chicago, was calm, orderly. There was no insurrection. If it had been a different site, maybe it would have been more chaotic. You know, you look at it in a way, Humphrey's positions in Chicago with the anti-war protesters was much closer on Vietnam than Nixon's. But I think, you know, when you're, you know, you're expressing an opinion about politics or protesting something, you're protesting the people in power. Of course, Nixon was out of office for 6 years. So Nixon's was orderly, no real threat to having the nomination. And he rolled up huge primary victories on the way to that nomination in Miami Beach.
Humphrey must have had the most difficult job in political history. He was a liberal icon as a senator, great supporter of civil rights, but then had, well, the worst job in politics as vice president for a difficult man. And he then became the nominee at a time of dissent and disorder following the assassinations of King and Kennedy. How does he try and navigate these currents in the party and the country?
Yeah, and I think everything you described there about Humphrey's experience as vice president dealt an advantage to Richard Nixon. Because Nixon understood what it was like to work to be vice president, and he understood what it was like to be vice president for a more charismatic president. And that way, Johnson had a similar experience. Having, I mean, not all presidents have been vice president. In fact, a lot of them have not been vice president. But here you have a case when the three major figures had all been vice president, and know that, you know, constitutionally, other than waiting for the president to die, you know, is this a nicer way to say it, is being a heartbeat away from the presidency and opening the Senate session, which is not terribly substantive, you don't have much to do as vice president unless you can negotiate those duties directly with your president. So I think Humphrey had a historic disadvantage, because if you show me the nominee of a party, I'll show you the leader of that party in most cases. And if you look at 1968 and, you know, who was the leader of the party, I think Lyndon Johnson still wanted to be the leader of the party. He was willing to give up the presidency, but not political relevance. And so I think Humphrey had the difficulty of being the nominee, of being an independent presidential candidate, but still serving Johnson at the same time as vice president. And so it's very complex, because Humphrey had the unique challenge of running effectively on change and continuity at the same time. So everything that he'd done for 4 years under Johnson, of course, was wonderful. Yet he had all these new proposals, as candidates do, for the next 4 years if they win and become president. Well, the first new idea you have, well, if it's such a great idea, why didn't you do it already? So that's what I mean by change and continuity simultaneously. And plus, any new idea that he had, if there was any perceived difference between Humphrey and Johnson, it created tension in that relationship. And so here again, I think where Harris and Biden is particularly relevant, it's not to say that it can't be done, but you're burdened with an additional challenge that someone not currently in an office, you know, has in the case of a Nixon in 68 or in the case of a Trump, you know, in 2024. That's the challenge that you have to overcome, is how do you run on change and continuity? And I would say in modern U.S. history, no one's really done it successfully. Nixon failed in 60. Humphrey failed in 68. You could go all the way to Gore in 2000. I think Hillary Clinton had a version of that in 2016. She was not vice president, but she was Secretary of State under Obama and was very close to his foreign policy positions. The only one in modern U.S. history who pulled it off, change and continuity simultaneously, was George H.W. Bush in 88. And I would argue Reagan was so popular still in the 80s that Bush ran much more on continuity than on change.
So how does Johnson deal with both Humphrey and Nixon?
As I say, Johnson was not a writer, so we can't document his day-to-day thinking. So I think the most original finding that I had in this book in terms of new source material came from an unlikely location. I had done an interview with Walter Mondale, former Vice President Mondale, in his law firm in Minneapolis in December of 2017. And as I say, when you do the interviews, it was the interviews that really influenced the structure of the book. And just as the Johnson people had told me to consider Wallace to be a full candidate, you know, treat him the same as Nixon and Humphrey in the book, and I think I mostly do that, It was Mondale who said to restore Johnson to a central place, try to document what Johnson was thinking during the book. What Mondale said to me, so Mondale in 68 was co-chair of Humphrey's campaign, which is often more symbolic. You want to balance the ticket geographically. You're not necessarily very involved in the campaign, fundraising perhaps. But what Mondale, which I didn't realize, you know, I find when I interview a politician, someone, you know, famous person, a president or a vice president, but you're asking them about a time in their political career where they weren't that famous. They're sometimes surprisingly aware or unaware of certain things. And so in 68, Mondale was merely a senator from Minnesota who had actually had Humphrey's old Senate seat. And this is what I didn't know. And he didn't write about it in his memoirs. He said, Humphrey and I became very close in the 70s when Humphrey was defeated and then came back to the Senate and then tragically died young of cancer late in the decade. He said, we talked about 1968 many times. And it almost seemed like I was getting Humphrey's perspective, you know, on 68. Of course, I never got to meet Hubert Humphrey as I was talking to Walter Mondale. And so at one point he interrupted me and he said, do you want to know what I think about 68? Absolutely. The result, he meant. He said, do I think that Lyndon Johnson wanted Hubert Humphrey to win? He said, absolutely not. He repeated that twice. Absolutely not. And to me, that sort of erases shelves of books that assume that, of course, Johnson would want his vice president to win, his the closest ideologically to him. So I'm a historian. You know, I look at records left behind by dead people. I don't do interviews. But I had to think of a follow-up. And so I said, well, what do you mean? Do you think that Johnson could have wanted Nixon to win? And so Mondale sort of paused and looked across the conference room, and then he sort of looked back at me, and he said, maybe, you know, maybe. And it was that interview, I'd never considered that perspective, which isn't in documents that historians look at. And so he encouraged me to really focus on Lyndon Johnson's mindset as much as possible in 68. And then 2 months later, a seemingly an unrelated figure, the Reverend Billy Graham, died, and leaving 70 years of papers that are still being opened now and will be open for many years going forward. And his diary, he has a section of his papers called his VIP notebooks. And they're a bit like diary scrapbook hybrid. I mean, some of it's sort of handwritten memories of what occurred that day. It might be correspondence with the president. But he documents contact with presidents, sometimes verbatim, with presidents from Harry Truman in 1950 to Barack Obama in 2016. And these are private records, so I had to get permission from the Grahams to see them. And the Grahams allowed me to see the volumes. There's 50-some books of these diaries. It's a massive record of presidential activity. And what I learned was that Graham actually operated as a messenger or a liaison or a back channel or whatever term you prefer between not just Johnson and Nixon, but also with Humphrey and Wallace. Former President Eisenhower was still very much alive and important in 1968. And Graham captured a lot of the conversations in here. And it was the Graham diary in particular that convinced me that after Robert Kennedy's assassination, which effectively gave the nomination to Humphrey, just as Rockefeller has become more critical of Vietnam, just as Humphrey seems to be promising something even bigger than the Great Society, in which, you know, the firmer part of Johnson's legacy that he was being concerned, could, you know, he could be forgotten by someone who's going to, you know, I might have gotten it started, but Humphrey will do it even better, the more traditional liberal than Johnson. Nixon was making surprisingly progressive statements on the campaign trail. I would say shaded in more of a Republican direction or a pro-market direction. So instead of big welfare programs, it was he would talk about black tax cuts or investments in the middle class or small business grants in urban areas. So all kind of coded language, sort of more pro-market, more Republican shading. But it made Nixon's proposals surprisingly compatible with Johnson. So effectively, I read it as an Nixon was the one more likely to end the Vietnam War in a way compatible with Johnson's own interests, whereas Humphrey was promising to get out basically in 6 months, and Johnson would be the first president to lose a war. But yet Nixon also wouldn't oppose the Great Society. And so Nixon as president, of course, no more ends the Great Society than Eisenhower does FDR's New Deal. And Nixon as president, the size of government doesn't shrink under Nixon. It actually grows over Johnson's Great Society. So I think what I'm suggesting in the book in future histories of the Nixon presidency is potentially a new way to view the entire Nixon presidency, that during the 4 years where Johnson's alive in Texas and Nixon's president, the way he ends the war, the way he goes to China, the way he goes to Moscow, all these were LBJ ideas. The creation of the EPA and progressive domestic policy of the environment, the genesis of all of Nixon's first term, which was very successful before Watergate, all came from Johnson. And so how much of that was meant to mute your strongest possible critic, who could do an awful lot, if you're Nixon, to mute Democrats on the Hill who control them the House and Senate? I don't know the answer to the question, but this book on 68 gives you a glimpse, I think, of a whole way, if you carry the thought process forward, of a whole new way of also viewing the Nixon presidency.
I mean, you've worked on Nixon extensively, working on the Nixon tapes, you're writing a book about Johnson now. Do you think there's similar characters, similar backgrounds in a way, similar resentments towards the establishment and things? Do you think there was a personal bond with them that underscores this as well?
It's a great question. There have been some writers who write about the presidency as being the loneliest job in the world, and that only if you've been the president do you understand the challenges of being president that other presidents have faced. And you know, some have called it the president's club, you know, the idea that sort of despite partisan differences, they are in touch with each other, and I suspect many of them are. I don't know how many of them have had good relations with Trump in recent years, even the Republican ones. But I do think they come to realize they need each other, despite public utterances to the contrary. And so Johnson and Nixon on the surface are very different. Democrat, Republican, you know, different, very different policies, temperaments, personalities. But, you know, this was a time period, don't forget, when there was considerable ideological overlap between the political parties. Both political parties had conservatives. Both political parties had liberals. You know, Nixon always said he considered Johnson to have moderately conservative instincts. Well, I would say the same thing about Nixon. You know, Nixon came of age out of the Earl Warren wing of the California Republican Party when it was okay to call yourself a liberal, just not too liberal.
Yeah.
When other Republicans called themselves practical progressives, meaning you weren't the party of no, who said no to everything of the New Deal, as FDR presented it. So Nixon was very much, they were both compromises, you know, of their own eras. But more so than what they had in common, the way I would say it, put it succinctly, is they despised each other when they were on the ballot against each other in some national election. But 68 was the first time they weren't. And so that allowed them to see that whether it was the establishment looking down or the national media, they had humble upbringings, they didn't go to the best colleges or private prep schools. I think they came to see they needed each other for their own legacies.
But they also both used the office of the presidency, the tools of the presidency, in manners that are deceptive, skirt the boundaries of legality and propriety and things. And almost the original sin of the Nixon presidency is his apparent, the allegations that he engaged in secret diplomacy with the South Vietnamese. Well, firstly, what are the allegations there?
Well, and I should say at the outset that the Chenault affair, as it's been called, is something that's been on the public record since, I think, the opening days of 1969. So it's something I came of age learning about. And like most of things that have been written about over and over in history, I assumed it was either true or at least mostly true. But the Chenault affair, you know, named for a Chinese-American businesswoman, Anna Chenault, who, you know, I come to a different interpretation in the book. You know, so the standard narrative of the Chenault affair is that Nixon utilized Anna Chenault, you know, during the most important phase of the 68 campaign as a kind of go-between or messenger to President Chu in South Vietnam to effectively say, don't cooperate with Lyndon Johnson's peace talks to end the Vietnam War in Paris that were going on, because if you hold off under a future President Nixon, you'll get a better deal. I think at its heart, that's the allegation, which has been written up many, many times, you know, almost as fact. And I assumed it was true or mostly true. What surprised me as I was researching this, you know, sort of dreading to have to deal with it and wondering whether I'd have anything new to say at all, was as I went through the previous books on the subject, I was surprised that none of them had actually interviewed Anna Chenault, for one, who was still alive very much, still lived at the Watergate in her penthouse apartment. No one had interviewed other principals like the South Vietnamese ambassador to Washington, who still lived in the Washington, D.C. area and became an American citizen after 1975. Or Chu's assistant, who knew a lot about this, who knew that the presidential palace in Saigon was being wiretapped by the CIA. And so the deeper I looked into it, I think often as a historian, when you see so many books written about a subject, it's bewildering because you think, what else is there? Can we possibly learn about a subject? when in fact, I think, unfortunately, the essence of history is that a lot of it's not rigorously researched, and a lot of the same stories get told over and over again, and very few researchers actually go back and check the source material. And so I would not say that they're wrong. Clearly, Chennault was maneuvering. Clearly, Chennault was meeting with the South Vietnamese. Clearly, Nixon had some contact with the South Vietnamese and Anna Chennault. But when I'm a little more inconclusive in my book, I don't say that it didn't happen. I say that if you add up the available evidence, it doesn't really say much of anything. And first and foremost, because so many records are still closed, Anna Chennault clearly had government contracts and had meetings with the CIA. I don't have meetings with the CIA. I don't have business with the U.S. government. So there's more to the story that we don't know yet, is what I would say.
But what is the suggested impact? Because really it's sort of tied into the idea that this was some dirty deal to win the election. So what is the suggestion that as to how it did impact the election?
So the suggestion is, so the Paris peace talks are going on. And so the United States delegation is meeting with the delegation from Hanoi, and they're trying to arrange some kind of a ceasefire or to enter a more serious phase of discussions. And so the idea is that Johnson had invited the South Vietnamese to attend those peace talks. The Americans understood that at a certain point, it had to be a Vietnamese agreement. North and South had to be present at the negotiating table. So the idea, at least, is that if Chennault can send a message to Thieu and say, refuse to take part, so to sort of obstruct the peace talks, then you could take from that that Nixon interfered, that peace was actually possible. Now, the difficulty is, of course, if you break down the logical components of the Chennault affair, you can see how easily others have gotten it wrong, or at least incomplete, in my opinion. So we're talking about an American communication from Chennault to the South Vietnamese. So we need to know what the communication was. We need to know the South Vietnamese reaction to that communication. We need to know whether they were going to go to the peace talks anyways. And we need to have some understanding that the communication had been blessed or directed by Richard Nixon. And so I think, to me, those are the logical components of the Chennault affair. And I don't think anyone's ever explained it that way. In terms of the Chennault communication to the South Vietnamese, we don't have it. I spent about a month in the archives in Ho Chi Minh City. There's a lot that hasn't been opened yet. Maybe it will exist, but Chennault doesn't claim there's a communication. The South Vietnamese I talked to doesn't claim there's communication. So therefore, there is no reaction from the South Vietnamese on going to the peace talks. Also, as I said at the time, the peace talks were only the United States and Hanoi. South Vietnam wasn't even part of the peace talks until after this process under the Nixon administration. So they didn't even play a role to object in any peace talks. And then finally, I interviewed all the members of the U.S. peace, the remaining ones of the U.S. Paris peace talks delegation. And some of the older ones, like Averill Harriman and Cyrus Vance, were long gone, but their assistants were around. And I remember I asked Harriman, Ambassador Harriman's assistant, I said, you know, was there a peace agreement? Because so many of the books have said something like, well, Nixon interfered with the peace agreement, you know, stated sort of in those terms. And he said, there was never a peace agreement. I said, what do you mean? He said, and we would have never documented an agreement because we had to maintain flexibility in negotiations. It was all done orally at sort of CIA safe houses in Paris suburbs. So this is why I cut my bottom line conclusion. During elections, there's all kinds of backroom things going on. And there was for this year, and there certainly was for 1968. But if you add up the available evidence, I find it surprisingly inconclusive. But at the same time, I keep an open mind because there are these intelligence records. There's more that hasn't been opened yet. And when it's opened, I certainly hope to be among the first to see them. And if the thinking shifts, I'll be glad to embrace it.
So Nixon ultimately wins. In terms of the popular vote, it's quite a narrow victory. But the map is interesting, particularly because of the role of Wallace, who wins a number of states in the South, which down the line in 1972 and onwards are firmly in the Republican coalition. When you look at the map of Nixon's victory, what do you see? What are the coalitions that underpin it?
There's a few things that I conclude in the book. First of all, I think the first draft of history was always that this was among the very closest elections in U.S. history. And I think up to that point, that's true. But I think that distinction is lost for younger people because especially since, say, 2000, Bush versus Gore, they've all been close. And we've had more than one occasion where the winner of the Electoral College actually lost the popular vote. And we might see that again this year, perhaps. And many pollsters say that we will. So that distinction has been lost. I think the popular vote is very close, within about 500,000 votes between Humphrey and Nixon. But when you look at the Electoral College, that blue and red map, it actually, I think, resembles more like Kennedy and Nixon in 1960. We're, again, close on the popular vote, but a little more decisive on the Electoral College. What I see in the red and blue states is a shift that had already been underway, even going back to Eisenhower and Nixon. People forget that Eisenhower and Nixon actually were the first Republican ticket to chip away at the South. And so you see the shifts beginning. They won Virginia both times, 52 and 56. They even won Louisiana in the Deep South in 56, so really in the heart of the Old South. So Wallace claws back those states. And so I don't think Wallace was decisive, and he didn't win enough Electoral College votes to make a difference. But if you look at the outcomes in certain states, like Texas, for example, which is interesting, being LBJ's home state, Wallace did win enough votes in certain states to make a difference in those states, even if not a difference overall in the election outcome. So what I'm seeing is, I think that, but also, again, this the process of this big shift that, especially these blue-collar, lower-middle-class voters that LBJ won almost all of in 64, I think they weren't quite sure what to do in 68. Mm. And Nixon won a fair amount of them. Some of them went for Wallace, and some of them were traditional Democrats who went for Humphrey. I think many of them went for Nixon in 72 and became Reagan Democrats. Yeah.
You quote Theodore White, the journalist who wrote a book about the election, saying that it was a negative landslide.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest with you, if you can summarize that election and potentially this election under the term backlash to various social political movements and disorder and...
Yeah, I think in 68, if you add together Nixon's total plus Wallace's, and so you don't see it as a close election between Nixon and Humphrey, you see it as Nixon plus Wallace against the status quo. It doesn't become a landslide, but it does look more like a decisive election, like an Eisenhower over Stevenson in 52 or 56.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Luke. This has been brilliant. You've been listening to EI Talks. The producer is Alistair Benn. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones. Thank you. See you next time.